in Bakersfield a couple times tonight. It's actually 34 years of continuous sobriety. Please help me welcome Pat.
Well, thank you so much, Bill. And yeah, good reminder about Rick and Carol. I met them when I lived in Riverside. Welcome everybody to the meeting, and enjoy the muffins. And hello to the folks on Zoom. Well, like Bill said, my sobriety date is May 1st of 1988. That was 34 years ago, just about this time of the evening. I was going to my first AA meeting at the Bruins Den in Long Beach, California, where I lived just north of Long Beach. Anyway, I just started, everything started attacking me in my head, like right before the meeting started, you know, like, dude, you have no energy, I'm just getting over a cold, and I just feel like I'm like, la la, and who cares, right? I mean, we're here because we're all alcoholic, and nobody's here because I'm speaking, okay? So, I'm reminding myself of that. As an egomaniac with an inferiority complex, which is kind of the thing that we alcoholics share, most of us anyway. You know, I think everything of myself, but I'm also, you know, I feel like I'm this small. So basically it comes down to that kind of thinking, which I'm mostly free of nowadays. But it's like, I think I'm like the most important piece of shit in the universe. So, anyway, I'm glad I'm here. And thanks again, Bill. I'm an alcoholic. I didn't know that for a long time, right? I just was a kid growing up in a big Irish Catholic family, you know. Nine kids, I had a couple things going on. You know, I've looked at some of this stuff, like doing inventory and things like that. You know, one of the gifts of the program is, you know, working the steps and doing inventory and taking a look at myself. And I discovered, you know, I had a couple things that really kind of helped me. It didn't make me an alcoholic, but it helped me. It was good that alcohol was around. First of all, of the nine kids in the family, I was the bedwetter. Like everybody else grew out of it. I was the sixth of nine, so even the three after me grew out of it. And I didn't. And I was horribly ashamed about that. And at the same time, I was a pretty precocious young boy as far as like reading. As soon as I learned to read, I just read everything I could get a hold of. And that included approved literature. As a Catholic, you know, there are things you're not supposed to read. And I read everything. And I knew by the time I was about 8 years old that I was probably going to have to pay the penalty for disobeying the rules. And in my mind, you know, I magnified it. It was like, it was so horrible that I probably was doomed to eternal damnation. So that was what was going on with me by the time I was about 8 or 9. Because I'm already feeling ashamed, and I'm feeling this sense of dread, you know, that would sneak in every now and then. And, you know, I would be going through my day, and then all of a sudden, it'd be or, you know, I would do something else, I would cross some line, and I would go, oh, man, I'm doomed. And so when alcohol came along, it was kind of a rescue. You know, it made me feel all right. It took away all of that shame and dread. And I didn't really start drinking regularly till about 14, but I remember, like, as an altar boy, I was, you know, we were in charge of taking the leftover wine, you know, not the consecrated blood of Jesus Christ. I'm not that crazy. But there was a passageway behind the altar, and I would drink the wine after Mass. Get a little buzz going, you know, because 10 years old, and then go home, go out in the neighborhood, and start feeling it, you know, start chasing after the girls in the neighborhood. There was a lot of girls, a lot of other big things in the neighborhood, so I was doing that, and in the meantime, you know, just going along, trying on the one hand to present myself, you know, as just a normal human being. But on the other hand, I just had a lot of turmoil inside. I don't know if you guys can identify with that, but it started pretty early for me. And then, you know, as I went to school, high school, I started really drinking, you know, at parties and, you know, smoking marijuana, you know, and sometimes smoking marijuana. And then going to school, you know, and how that works is usually I, you know, didn't do very well in some classes, you know, but it was weird because I had like this kind of mixture. I played sports, and I was on like they had this thing called the brain game. It was like a competition between high schools, but like I can't even think of what the word is now, but like you're on a panel, you know, and it's like a trivia game. Yeah. And I was on the team for that. But I was on it for two different, and these were like shows on TV in the city, in Indianapolis. But I got stoned on the way to the competition, and I actually buzzed one time, and they asked me, you know, to answer the question, and I just wasn't even present, you know. I was just like, sorry, I didn't mean to do that. And it was kind of, you know, embarrassing. And stuff like that happens sometimes, and then I would like have, you know, I would like get some kind of like award for a class that I took that I was really good in, and then I would mess up again. I'd go home and I was a bedwetter. So I had this sort of like dual life, you know. And alcohol just, you know, started really becoming very important to me. And you know, it's other things, but I didn't really get into too much of that until I went away to college, and I went to Indiana University, which was the one place that I applied to because, you know, I was from a big family and my parents were paying for it, so I had to come up with my own funding, and it was the cheapest option, even though my mom said it was a godless, atheistic institution, and that was part of the reason why I wanted to go too, you know, to show mom. It's weird, you know, this whole, and it sounds so cliche, but I've looked at that a lot too. The relationship that I had with my mother was very, very codependent. You know, I wanted to please her no matter what. And I realized that I've carried that through into other relationships in my life, you know. And it's only like I am just scratching the surface in a lot of ways of that kind of stuff right now about who I am as a person and how I relate to other people. But it's so weird because it's like, you know, back then when I was drinking, I felt like I could connecting with people and you know, girls liked me and women found me charming and my friends thought I was great, but there was always this thing inside me that just wasn't, like it just didn't feel right, you know. And I graduated from college, didn't have a very good GPA because I was an accounting major because my girlfriend was an accounting major. And that's why I chose accounting. And I hated it and I sucked at it. And so I got out of college, didn't know what to do, moved back home with my parents, jumped into working at a bar and restaurant. And that seemed like a pretty good deal, you know. And I became the general manager of this place like a year after I started working there. And it was crazy because I was just 24, 25 years old, just like, with like trying to run a business, you know, and I just wasn't emotionally prepared for it. And I drank a lot and I did a lot of drugs and did a lot of drugs in my office, you know, and they were just all a part of trying to get through. I didn't know it at the time, but that's, you know, basically I figured out that I started a long time ago acquiring survival tactics, that my alcoholism really was about this sense that nothing was going to take care of me and I had to do it myself. And, you know, there could be all sorts of people around me, all sorts of resources offered, but I had this thing inside me that said, I have to be in charge. I have to run the show. And it really, you know, took me through most of my life up to that point. I had, you know, some relationship issues, and then like in the mid-20s, I was doing a lot of, you know, one-night stand kind of things. And I think that there's a term for it. It's sport effing, I think I'm trying to think. But and so, you know, and I was drunk, and I kind of got the reputation for being a drunk. So much so that, like, you know, right before I moved from Indianapolis out to Southern California, my nickname had, because I lived in this area called Broad Ripple Village, and it was like all these bars and restaurants and everything, and my nickname became Otis, like the guy on the Andy Griffith Show that was the town drunk. And so that's who I was. And again, like, there was like this other side of me. And I met this young lady who worked at a place that I was working at. And we started going out and we kind of fell in love. And she had a sister that lived out in California, and we came out to visit her in 1987. And while I was out here, I went and visited an old friend from college who was an accountant at this company, and I ended up getting a job with this company selling forklifts. You know, I didn't have any idea about how to do that, but it was like a way to get out of Indiana, way to, like, maybe, in my mind, because, like, when I was a bartender, I'd see these sales would come in and they'd be like all done with their day at like 3, and you know, like doing, you know, got a lot of money, it seemed like, and it's like, man, that's what I'd like to do. And you know, I had some other ideas about things I wanted to do with my life as well. I had started doing some acting in like local theater companies in Indianapolis, and then I kind of had the idea that I would like to do that, you know, because, like, I got a couple good reviews, you know. And so coming out of California, there was, like, I had this job, and I was, like, had this thought in my mind, you know, going to Hollywood. And So I moved out to California in 87, and I lasted about 7 months. I was drinking all the time, and it was weird, because, like, in Indiana, I didn't have to drive very much when I was drinking, because I lived in a neighborhood where you could just walk and drink. But in L.A., I was, like, having to drive all over the place, and apparently, you know, they don't like that when you're driving drunk. And it actually, it wasn't the first time. I had gotten arrested once in college for drunk driving, and I got arrested another time in 1985 while I was, after I had left my job as general manager of the restaurant in Barre. I got a job, my brother and sister worked at this camp, this summer camp in Bemidji, Minnesota, called Camp Thunderbird. And I got hired to take the kids out on the Western trip to the American and Canadian Rockies. And I got arrested while I was driving them around for drunk driving. And yeah, God, I'm so grateful that I didn't kill them, you know, because it was crazy, you know. And that didn't stop me, you know, I kept going. But then finally in 1980, I moved to California in 87. On April 30th of 1988, I woke up, I had a really bad hangover. I had things I wanted to do. I was engaged to be married to a beautiful woman. I had, you know, a 1-year-old car. I was rolling, I was making more money than I ever made. And I woke up and I just had this sense of emptiness. Like I just knew that the only thing that was going to make me feel anything was if I went and drank again. You know, and I had started trying to quit it on my own. But it's so weird how it worked, you know, because I had that sense, and I drove over to this bar in not Redondo Beach, but Hermosa Beach, called the Poop Deck, and it's not a gay bar. Sounds like it. but anyway, I don't know why I love it. But anyway, on the way there, I was like, oh my, I saw somebody who was broke down on the side of the road, and for a moment I thought, oh man, I can stop and help them. And like, my heart jumped, like I had something to live for. That's how desperate I was. But they had called AAA, so I went on. And I went and I started drinking, and I made the acquaintance of this guy who had just gotten arrested for drunk driving, and I gave him a ride back to his place, and he called all his buddies over. We're all drinking and doing other stuff, and we decided to go to the Dodger game, and I said, I'll drive, and we went to the Dodger game, and I got pulled over on the way there, and they gave me a ticket, but they didn't arrest me because that would have bumped everybody else's trip. So we went to the game. I remember, like, don't go to Dodger Stadium if you have a weak bladder, because I, like, pissed my pants when I didn't find it to go to the bathroom. I mean, that's how drunk I was. And then we went to, like, a strip bar afterwards, and I just remember, like, sitting there, and I'd been drinking all day, and I just felt like nothing. Just was like, fuck. And I dropped all those guys off after that, and I was on my way back to my place, and I got pulled over from driving, and I failed the sobriety test, and they hooked me up. I was in the back seat. It was a L.A. County Sheriff deputy. It was a young woman and her trainer, and I think I might have been her first arrest, because she was so excited that she left all the paperwork on top of the car. And as we drove off, it, like, blew back, you know, down the 110 freeway. And I just remember, like, I saw her, like, like looking forward. But something was starting to happen to me. And I had my hands hooked up and I leaned forward and I said, it's going to be okay. And I said that to her, but I heard it. And it was something that was starting to happen, like inside me. It's like I needed to be rested. So I had gotten to that point, and I didn't know anything about alcoholism yet. You know, I had an experience when I was in jail, you know, that night and the next morning, where I saw myself as this, like, lonely old man with nothing, just having a drink, you know, just, like, old and just, you know, just sitting there drinking. And I knew that's what was going to happen to me. I mean, I was absolutely convinced of it. It was like I was given this vision, you know. And I said, God, please don't let it be like this. And something just kind of, like, happened inside me. It was like darkness, and then all of a sudden I could see way off, like this light sort of like gently flowing towards me. I know it's kind of weird, but it's as close as I can come to what happened. And I just started feeling like this hope, like that something should be different. I didn't know how, you know, and I went home and I tried to sleep because I'd been up all night, and then I called my fiance who's still back in Indiana. And we talked, and I told her I was alcoholic. I said, it was like the first time I had gotten to that point where I didn't think I could quit anymore. And I was absolutely convinced. So I had gotten to the end of myself. I'd gotten to the end of my self-sufficiency. My feeling like that I could be, well, that I had power. That I could choose, but and I had that experience. And so when I told her about that, she was a good, you know, Al-Anon at that point. And we got on the phone, and then she called me back and said, "Call Alcoholics Anonymous." And that was my first. I mean, my ex-brother-in-law had tried to, you know, get me to meetings, and I thought I was going there to be nice to all you poor, you know. Poor sots, you know, show you how to, like, you can live, you know, successfully and drink, you know, because I was clueless. But finally it hit me. And I went to my first meeting that night at the Bruins Den, Long Beach, and the guy that I had talked to on the phone became my first sponsor. And he was a little bit different. He said, when I asked him to be my sponsor, because I basically asked him to be my sponsor because everybody was saying, you got a sponsor, you got a sponsor. You know, you keep going to meetings and everybody says, you got a sponsor. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to get a sponsor. So I asked him. He said, yeah, I don't work the program like everybody else does. I just, when I have a resentment, I just picture the person and I pop my belly button and they disappear and the resentment is gone. And I said, okay, I will take that into consideration. But, you know, it's so weird because you know how you are when you get sober and you've got all these freaking ideas about what you think is going to work. And then, you know, that was such a gift to be given. Like this guy that was 5 years sober, who I thought was like just, you know, a god, and he was crazy as fuck, you know? But he was sober too, you know? And by that time, I had seen that there were other people that were getting it. You know, I think that was one of the best things that happened, is like they said, keep coming back. And I did. I don't know what happened, but I wanted so badly. But I think it was because I just hated my life, you know. I was this dodgy forklift salesman having to go and like try to you know, get people to buy something I didn't even fucking know about, excuse my language, I didn't have really any interest in. I was just trying to do it because I was trying to make some money, you know, because I needed to, because I was a, you know, human being. And so Alcoholics Anonymous came on. I remember it's like, I loved just going to meetings and talking to new people. And, you know, and then I started, you know, I got 30 days and I was like, man, that's amazing. And I got 60 days and that was just beyond even anything I could imagine. And so on and so forth, you know, and I started, well, and then I'm trying to remember, my fiance, we were supposed to get married in September of 88 and we postponed until the next July. And she instead moved out to California. When I was 3 months sober, she moved out with me. And man, she was like 2 weeks after she got there, she just looked at me and said, "You are so weird." You know, because I was sober and I didn't have the sort of like filters that I'd had before of alcohol, you know, and it was freaking her out, you know, and we stayed together. I started working the steps, which I recommend. You know, my first four step though, it was weird because this was back in the day when we didn't have cell phones yet, and she had my keys in her purse, and then she had to go down to see her sister, and I didn't have any. I was blocked out of my house and my car. And so I didn't have any resources until I had to climb up like a pole and break into my apartment. And then I was able to call and tell her sister, you know, what happened. By that time she was gone too far. So I just started writing the fourth step at that point because it had been on my, you know, it had been nagging me. And I was like, wow. Good opportunity. And so the first four step was just like, blah. You know, I just kind of like put everything out there, you know, that had been bothering me all my life, you know, about stuff that I had done. And I didn't really follow the format in the book at that point, but I had something down, you know, it was like a start. And I did a better one. And I've done about two or three more after that. But it made a difference, you know. It's like I was willing and it got me through that first year. And I, you know, life went on. I got married to that woman. We had a daughter who's never seen me drunk. She's 28 years old now. She teaches in Prague. But, you know, what happened was I was still really messed up. I was still really alcoholic. And we split up, her mom and I, before my daughter's second birthday. And then I moved to West LA to be an actor because I had that in me, you know. I stayed sober, you know, kept coming back. I did not drink. I kept working the program to the best of my ability. And, you know, life went on. And I was able to make the amends that I needed to make that I didn't think I could ever make to people. And I was able to, you know, show up for my daughter no matter what. That's something that, I was given by this program. Even though I didn't live with her, I talked to her every day. And we have a really close relationship today. And, you know, I was going along and I was trying to be an actor. I was doing the program. I was diagnosed with hyperthyroid and Graves' disease, and that kind of messed with me. And then I was diagnosed with depression, and I just kept coming back, you know, and I started talking to other alcoholics and taking them through the spectrum. And my life was tough sometimes, you know. I was like, I remember one time I had to clean my sponsor's garage, like the last $47 I needed to pay rent. And it was like this garage was just horrible. It was like the Herculean task, you know, like cleaning out the shit. And it was just nasty, but you know, the common thread has always been Alcoholics Anonymous. Like, I got sober in Long Beach, I moved to West LA, lived in West LA, Venice, moved back to Long Beach, and the AA was always there, you know. And my ex-wife remarried, and that was kind of funky. You know, her husband kind of wasn't real cool about me coming to see my daughter, and that was a tough thing, and I worked through it. And I just kept going to meetings, you know, kept doing the program. I got laid off from my job in 2002, and I decided to go back to school, and I had, you know, not done very well in college. But somehow, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was able to go through the steps it took. I applied for a master's program at Cal State Long Beach in religious studies, and I got my master's, and then I applied for a PhD program at the University of California, Riverside. And I got accepted to that, and I finished that. Well, I didn't actually finish it until a year after. I got hired by Cal State Bakersfield to teach religious studies. And I moved up here in 2014, and I've been at that job now for the longest I ever had any job in my life. And I did finish my dissertation. I did get my PhD in 2015. And I mean, you know, it's just beyond belief, you know, like I was this kind of dodgy forklift salesman when I got sober. And it's like I've heard it said, you know, you can't really get, how do you get here from there? And you know, I've heard people with a lot of, like, greater obstacles than that, you know, and because this program is so powerful. You know, what it does, like, on a daily basis, is it gives me what I need to stay in this, you know, place, in this existence that I found so challenging, you know, as an alcoholic. It keeps me in the game, so to speak, you know. I get a daily reprieve from all that alcoholic madness in my head that still can come up, you know. I can still get really pissed, or, you know, somebody doesn't treat me right, or, you know, doesn't answer my call, or, I'm still so sensitive to, and I've gotten back into a relationship that's really interesting, but I won't go on about that, but it's been pretty challenging, and because I wasn't in one for a long time, and I split up with my wife, so that's my next stage, you know. It's like life is still in session. I have to still be, you know, coming back and staying sober and helping other alcoholics, and that's the main deal. It's really, you know, what it's about. Ultimately, it's not anything that I can achieve or anything that I can gain of material possession. It's about a life of just showing up and, like, being with you guys and just saying, hey, here I am. help you. And then, and you guys help me all the time too. That's the other thing. That's the secret. It's like, for like newcomers and then people all along the way. The old timers, which I guess I'm starting to be one, we get this. We get so much help. It's like life is like cheating sometimes in a way. It feels like it's like all I have to do is like show up and breathe sometimes and just let my higher power take care of me and just do some simple things on a daily basis. And I haven't had to take a drink. Fuck. That's amazing. Anyway, I don't know. Did I go way over?
I think you did fine.
Okay. Well, I think that's it. All right.
Well, thank you, Pat.
I guess, it's funny, I've known Pat for years, and somehow I'm kind of embarrassed to admit it, because I know you've been here in my site, and you've told your story before.
I did, yeah, that was at that big center place.
Yeah, on Wednesday night.
Is that when it was?
Yeah, that was a few years. So I'm sure this shouldn't be news to me, but it would seem, you're a very humble guy, but it would be appropriate to use the term Dr. Pat. So
that's what we do, right?
Right. I'm not that kind of doctor.
Well, thank you, Pat.
All right.
And so we are now going to start the discussion portion of the meeting. We'd like to hear from as many different people as possible, so please let me be sharing so that we get an opportunity to hear from as many people as possible. And with that, I'm going to turn the meeting back over to Dr. Pat. And here are the in-person attendees, here are the online attendees.
Okay.
And we just
kind of... So what do? Do I call on them, or do they raise their hand? Okay. How about... Well, Bill, would you like to share you about raising
Sure. Hey, I'm going to plug my Bill Hatchman, and
Bill.
Kind of a funny deal. It's kind of funny how I think this should never surprise me, right? That God has created the universe and everything in it and everyone in it, that same creator, whatever that is, could coordinate just, you know, the seemingly craziest combination of things. Like, you know, I mentioned before that Pat knows my friend Rick, and Rick took me through the steps, and Rick taught me a lot of really valuable things in my life, and it's easy for me to get this notion that I shouldn't need any more help by then. Surely by now, I've learned enough to be able to manage my own life and do a good job of it. And the truth of the matter is that I don't live a life full of unmanageability, but I'm still incapable of everything that I could aspire to be. It's kind of funny. I've for many, many years, I found myself disqualifying many of the religious practices in our society, right? So I grew up going to, I think, probably the same church you did, and I somewhere along the line, so my parents put me in the right place to get an education to learn about these things, and somehow, some way, at some point in my life, I began to put together anecdotal pieces of information to construct this great argument against the religions of the world. And one of maybe some of you guys have been here too, right? One of the thoughts I thought was, in 2005 when I got sober, there was a tsunami that went through,
Thailand.
in that area. And there were movies made about it and stuff, and there were thousands of people that were killed, and many, many women and children. I mean, look, I'm a guy, I'm a dirtbag, I've harmed a lot of people. I can see where other guys or bad guys touch take them out with this rap, right? But there's definitely innocent children and women in the world, right? That got swept up in that raid. And how is it possible that a God that loves the people that he's put on this planet, how could he exist and that tragedy also exist? And so that for me was just another example of how you could go to childhood cancers and stuff like that too, right? And there's a million different examples, right? But these things prove to me to be the logical argument against the existence of a God and a loving God. And so I can't really tell you where this came from. It probably, I'm sure it didn't come from me, but someone must have suggested a different way of looking at it. And so what happened was somebody said this to me, but the idea finally crossed my mind that maybe there is a paradise that we exist in after our physical lives are extinguished, right? Maybe that could be. I mean, we have a name for it, right? We call it heaven, right? And so rather than these people losing their lives being some tragic thing, it's like they're the lucky fuckers to get to go there today, you know? And look, I don't know any of that. But just being open to the possibility that that might be the situation, it made me think about maybe I don't know everything. Maybe all these logic arguments that I've made about God are in fact just as false as the God that I had made them against, or the arguments that I made against the God. What I'm trying to illustrate here is that I suppose people in my life who have given me an opportunity to see situations from the vantage point that I didn't have on my own, right? Give me a different perspective on the situation and allowed me to think, wow, you know what? Maybe there's another explanation here. And as a result of those kinds of, I like to think of them sometimes as spiritual experiences or spiritual awakenings. As a result of those things in my life, I've been able to, I think at one point we were talking about sort of feeling like oppressed by the realities of the world. And somehow, some way, you just get this alternative perspective, and it seems like it offers hope. And hope that maybe I don't have it all right. Maybe things are different than they are. And you know, the crazy thing is I know that part of living, it would seem, there's ample evidence, is that we are going to experience pain. Suffering, however, is entirely a matter of choice. So I've experienced, I had a situation, I've had a number of episodes of kidney stones. I don't know if you guys ever had kidney stones. I've heard people say that the kidney stones, an episode, can be as painful as childbirth. I don't know if that's true. I think a cold is as bad as childbirth, but when I have it. But anyway, it's definitely a painful experience, right? And several years ago, during my current stretch of sobriety, I was in bed one night and I had a sensation that usually precedes the kidney stone episode, and it was painful, it was uncomfortable, and I kept getting up trying to figure out, you know, how to make this pain stop, and I couldn't, and I don't know where this came from, and it had to come from what you guys have taught me, but I laid back down and I just said a prayer. I said, God, I don't know why I'm experiencing this. I don't want to go to the emergency room. I don't want to have to go through all this because I've been down this road before and I know what happens. And I said, please just show me what it is that you would have me learn in this pain. Please show me what you have me learn in this pain. And the pain went away.
explain. I don't know. I can't explain to you why or how. I think. I personally still believe that God took that pain away at that moment to show me just how much power he has. That's what I believe. You don't have to believe it. I don't believe a lot of the miracle stories I hear other people say. I would not be offended if you don't believe my story. But anyway, one of the topics that I wanted to learn more, and I have been reading, I've been reading literature of a spiritual nature, I guess you could say, trying to get a better understanding of some of the old texts. And I've often thought, gosh, you know, who could I talk to that could maybe, you know, help me understand what I'm reading a little bit better? And then Pat shows up and says he's a religious studies guy. And I'm thinking, yeah, I could do that.
Yeah.
So anyway, thanks for letting me share.
Thanks.
Thanks,
Bill. How about Desiree on the Zoom?
Hello, Desiree, alcoholic addict.
Hello.
Is there a topic in particular, or just like a?
I didn't give one. How about whatever you want to talk about?
Okay. Well, thank you for your share. You know, things come up every time I hear people share, and I'm just happy that I am sober. You know, it feels good to actually listen to people share now and look forward to speaker meetings and stuff like that. You know, these are my favorite now. And before, I would find them so annoying. You know, I would be like, oh, my God. You know, I wouldn't even go to them, actually. I probably did one, but now I actually look forward to speaker meetings, you know. I'm almost 5 months clean and sober. I'm on step two. So everything's pretty good, you know. I'm happy to be here, grateful every day. Writing in my sponsor suggested for me to be grateful, you know, and before she's showing me a lot of things that it's like it's incredible, you know, things I didn't know about myself. And it's like, whoa, this is me, you know. And it feels good to learn, because before I was like in a deep sleep, you know, I was I'm grateful to be here, and with that, I'll keep coming back. That's all I got. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Desiree.
Thank you, Desiree.
Chris, you want to share?
Yeah, I'll share. Chris, alcoholic.
Hey, Chris.
Hey, Chris. Hey, Chris.
Doing good. We have 45 days to work today.
All right.
Now, time for recovery. You know, when I first came in, it's just like, oh, man, another program. It's my third program, and I came in for other reasons, you know, not alcohol, for drugs. And, you know, I was getting a lot of trouble being arrested in this county quite a few times, and, you know, they gave me another chance. And I was totally against being there. I didn't want to be there. And once I got there, I said, no, I've got to do this, or I've got to accept it, and I've got to gain something from it. I'm going to be here. I need to learn something from this change in Jesus and with me. Whether I want to be here or not, you know, I'm going to be in good spirits about it, not being drunk every day, fight the program. And every single day that I've been there, I've learned something new about myself, gained some kind of knowledge. Right? You know, I'm trying to act as a sponge and learn as much as I can. And I see myself growing within the program and in my sobriety. You know, like I said, I came in for drugs, but I'm also an alcoholic. I've had 4 DUIs and some drunk advances, you know. I've caused a lot of people harm, including my children, you know, emotionally, mentally, physically. I was in denial, and I minimized it, and I'm not an alcoholic. I can have a few beers. I haven't had a DUI in 5-6 years. But now that I look back and I go through and start to do this moral inventory, and I'm like, hey, I haven't put it on paper yet, so I'm scared to look at it. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a full-blown alcoholic. You know, and I still find myself to this day having reservations. Like, man, I want beer so bad. Red beer, it's lava or whatever. And, but somehow it gives me the strength to not go act on those thoughts and to redirect my thoughts. And I'm very grateful for that. I'm very grateful for the program, AA, NA, all of it in a whole, a higher power. I mean, if I didn't have that right now, I don't know what I'd do. I probably would have walked out of there, you know? I met a lot of great guys. You know, I appreciated one of you guys. I love hearing your guys' stories. Especially the people that have been sober for many years in this program work for them, because everybody's kind of got their own little way of doing things in their own group, you know, which, I mean, he's playing that course. And, but it gives me a different perspective on the whole sobriety thing and the recovery thing. And, you know, I can see different ways, different paths that he's led other people and kind of build my own along my way, you know. So, that being said, I'll keep coming back and I'll think about it's worth.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. Chris. What about, Santos?
What was that?
Santos.
Yes, sir.
Want to share?
My name is Santos. I'm an alcoholic.
Yes, sir.
I'm just right here enjoying the night in the back, watering my plants, listening in on you guys' testimonies. And, it's pretty good to hear you guys talk, man. Hello?
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah, I just take it day by day, man. Just, you know, I know how it is. You know, like, you guys are way above me being sober and sobriety. So I'm astonished at you guys' birth dates and years. I just take it day by day, man. I'm here every week.
Yeah, man.
So, that's about it.
Good to see you, Santos. Thanks, Santos. Yeah, that's how I did it. Just every day, you just keep showing up and the days add up. Just don't drink and don't die.
That's it.
All right. What about Dave?
My name is Dave, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Dave.
Thanks for sharing that. Sure. Just like Mark was talking about the light. You know, when you said that, I thought about my six-year-old daughter. That was my life when I cried to God. And I was hungover. I prayed to God. And my six-year-old daughter came out and told me, some type of course going up, that stuff, whatever. At 9 o'clock in the morning, I prayed to God to come back and be a sign. Tell me something, you know, or I'm just going to leave and not come back, you know, so I was putting my kids through shit, through hell, you know. And my six-year-old daughter came out and told me, Dad, get help. My dad back. And, that was my life. That was me. Hit my rock bottom, that desperation, you know, seeing the disappointment on her face, you know, and her not even really realizing or knowing why I was sick, but she knew I was definitely, there was something wrong with her. For me and my journey today, you know, I've been 8, 9 in my step work, and I never made it that far. I made it that far, but I wasn't honest and open and thorough, you know, and willing. I wasn't any of those things, you know, when I made that far before, and it didn't mean shit to make it that far. You know, I wrote it down on paper and made my sponsor happy, and got people off my back, and this, that, and the other, and thought I was doing something, thinking it to make it, you know, but basically that shit came back and just hit me in the ass. But today, I'm working on 8 and 9, and wrote down some of my harms on these cards. Some of the sponsors got me doing, you know. And like I said, I did that before, didn't mean shit. I went out and made some of those bins and didn't feel it. I thought that's where I was supposed to feel nothing, I guess, you know, then. But today, I really got the feeling of the program, and I really got the feeling of that step work. The first one, you know, was myself, and I worked on that one. I haven't looked in the mirror, taking care of that one yet. That's the deep one right there. But my second one was my kids. and I reached out to my two oldest daughters, and just through text, and because they still want to talk to me, like, face to face, because they live back east. They're not ready for all that, just to understandable. We text each other, it happens for like 3 years, every now and again I'll get a wild hair and I'll think, but, oh well, we're texting, you know, for the past 30 minutes, and she's telling me how good she's doing, and I'll push the video chat, and she'll hang up, and she's like, that's not great. You know what I mean? And it is what it is. I did that. You know, I just gotta be patient, you know. I did that shit. That's my fault. You know, she's 23, my other daughter, she's 19, 18. And they're not ready to be, so I didn't understand. But I needed to make an amends being a shitty dad when they were growing up. You know, I wasn't there for a lot of years. So I poured my heart out to them, and I told them sorry, you know, wholeheartedly, and just let them go, you know. Sorry for not being there when I was growing up. And I told them all the same thing, you know, my oldest daughter. So I'm proud of you, Dad. You know, she shouldn't call me Dad hard. She doesn't call me Dad, she doesn't call me Dave, but she doesn't say Dad, you know, and she's like, I'm proud of you, Dad. You know, I love you, and I want you to know that I need you. And she's never said that to me.
Mm.
You know, she said, I need you, Dad. So I'm glad you're on the path that you're on. And she knows everything. I taught her everything. You know, she's like, you're doing what you need to be doing right now, and I want to see you go back, and I need you. Just keep on doing what you're doing, and I forgive you. And my younger daughter, she actually told me, I love you, Dad, and I forgive you for that past. You know, that wasn't my dad. You're my dad today. You know, I felt that shit, every bit of it. I still feel it. You know, the record of my past, you know, it's a beautiful thing to be able to be open and just do this right this time, you know, and these things that I get to do today, you know, it's truly a beautiful life and the program works. And like I said, you know, like Chris said, you know, I love seeing somebody with years or even just a year, you know, if they make it to a year, you know, if they're doing it honestly, hopefully, and thoroughly, this program does work. It does work, and it only works if you work it. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. That's all you got, huh?
Oh, no, I got a lot more. Thank you. That was fun.
Let's see. Let's see. Leah? You want to share?
My name's Leah. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey,
Linda.
Hey,
so yeah, really good chair, Pat. Yeah, don't be ashamed, I'm a bedwetter. never really grew out of it, just less frequent. You know, I'm just coming out of relapse, and I've been thinking lately, and well, just coming to terms with trying to get out of that black and white thinking, I guess they call it, just like, okay, I was doing the work, I was going to the meetings, and working steps and all that, and finally putting some time between me and the last time that I drank, and all of a sudden, without warning, bam, you know, I was drinking again. And so what went wrong? You know, everything was going good and out of nowhere. And, I was more that self-destructive substance, alcoholic shit that ruined my life before, and something I must have missed. And Bill reminded me that, you know, that I have to take this relapse and try to figure out what happened, you know. I did that, and so now I know where it came from, and now I can work on that. For myself, it was my guilt. It had a major impact on me, like, you know, I guess subconsciously, and if, you know, if you're being aware of it, means that I can work on that, you know, that underlying issue, and I'm glad it's uncovered, because I can actually work on it, and regardless of the reason why we relapse, or, you know, you can't let it consume you. And it's extremely frustrating and humiliating, and it's shameful. You feel shameful, and it's just those typical feelings that come with relapse. And at first, I was feeling like a failure, and all that hard work I put into my recovery. All the women, the ladies that looked up to me. Last Wednesday, that hit hard, you know, that serenity prayer, I actually felt every word of it when I said it, you know. God grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can. Because no matter what I did in the past, I can't change those things. They happen, you know. They happen. That's part of my story already. Now, I gotta work on it, you know, that guilt that I feel over it. And it would be easy for me to point blame game and, you know, this person, this trigger, whatever. It's not anybody's fault. It's mine. I got to take ownership of my relapse. Got to allow myself to move on. Again, that black and white thinking. I got to let go. I got to let go that guilt. Got to let go of that guilt. And I'm really got a really good sponsor and. That I didn't use when I needed to, but now that I, it's life or death, you know. Next time I might die, you know. I got to get myself back into it. Otherwise, who knows where I would be? You know, I know I don't want to be there. I know I want to be here, and I know I got a good support system and great people in my recovery, you know. I get out of that black and white thinking, you know, and there's no specific formula. There's no specific formula for recovery. Everyone has their own path. Everyone's path is different, and some people relapse, some people don't. But I'm not going to take it as starting over. Just as taking it a couple steps back and. It's not going to be a major setback for me. I'm going to take it one day at a time and do what I can to get over that guilt that I feel. And I'm just glad that I can attack it and grab it by the throat and choke it. You know, so just want to say thank you, Bill.
Thanks, Leah.
Thanks, Dan. Danny. I'm Danny. I'm an alcoholic. Yeah, Danny. Awesome, Dave. I'm really proud of you.
I'm doing okay, but I'm
thank you. I'll take another 24.
I'm on my 4-step, and I just can't write anything out of value. It's so many things that I've done and seen and been a part of that I really just want to just forget them, but I can't do that. I got patience shit and, the biggest resentment is for things that I've done, you know. I wasn't around with my kids when they were growing up. You know, I missed all of this shit. I missed short days. I missed all kinds of shit. I missed, you know, being high or drunk was my art. And, so a whole lot of guilt to that shit. I said, I have 2 daughters and they're great kids. I was just turned 40 a couple months ago. I started doing that. But, you know, I have amends to make to them, but I got to get started on this 4-step. I've been putting it off. But I am going to go home after this meeting. I'm going to go home and instead of turning the TV on and watching Shameless again, I'm going to start writing some shit down on my 4-step and keep going. My sponsor has been very patient with me. Thank you. Thanks, David. But, I gotta get this shit done, and, I wanna get it done, because I hear, once you get through the 4-step, get rid of a lot of that shit. You know, and that's why I got so much shit in my head that I need to get rid of it. I need to get rid of it. I gotta get rid of it. Get over the shame and the guilt from all the shit that I've done and the wrongs I've done to people and myself. You know, I robbed myself of pretty much 47 years of my life. You know, I'm gonna turn 61 in December, and I've been drinking and using something pretty much continuously since age of 13. You know, it's, and Dave, you said something a while ago, I just want my dad back. That's what put me back in mind this time. My oldest daughter, we sit in her eyes, I'm drunk. She said, you need help, Dad. And all I want is my dad back. And I called, she called Brian, no, David, Dave Anderson, told her, get him sober, take him in and get a health check done, get him a COVID test, and get him over here tomorrow. And next morning, I said, after slamming a pint of whiskey on the way there, and 8 days in detox out there, shaking and puking and couldn't eat. And right now I'm fighting. I've been fighting the urge to drink. You know, I walk by, I walk my dog every morning. I walk by the Mexican guy that sits in the oleander down there by the ANW, it's Larry, sitting under drinking him. And Daddy Daddy's. 24s of those, that's all he does, sit there and drink these things. And the thoughts keep coming in my head. I just stop at Jack's right there and grab a beer. Grab me a big old 24 and slam that fucker down. I'll feel good. Nobody turn it off. But I'll fucking know.
Yeah, let's see that, Jeff.
And I don't want to go back to that fucking hell. I went through hell. I've come back, and I don't want to go back again. So, and I'm going to start that 4-step. I want to get it done. I want to get that shit out and be able to move forward there. You know, I'm happy with where I'm at. I'm like almost 8 months, I think. Well, the times went by faster than I thought it would. I remember waiting for that first 30 days, you know, and it's finally, hey, 30 days, God damn, how did I do that, you know? And coming to realize that I didn't do it. Because sometimes my higher power is in there walking with me. He's been with me all my life, but I didn't pay attention. Could have been a lot more than what I am now. If I had just chose the right path instead of going down the one I did. I'm really self-destructive, but I hurt myself more than I hurt other people. I guess I get off on that shit, making myself suffer. And I know how to do it. I'm good at it. But anyway, thanks to my higher power, I got another 24 in, and I wake up tomorrow morning, do the same thing I've been doing, and hopefully I'll drink tomorrow. That's all I got.
You have time for one, or?
Sure.
We have time for a quick one. On the Zoom, Laurel, do you want to share?
You're going to need that.
Laurel or
L'Oreal?
L'Oreal, sorry.
Hello, everybody. L'Oreal, alcoholic addict. You guys are always cutting me short on my shares. No, I'm just kidding. I just want to say thank you for everybody who shared. I text Leah to check on her, and she asked me to join, so I figured I'd join and support her. That's what we do. And our group, and I just want to say, you know, Leah, I'm very proud of you. You're an inspiration even to myself. You know, we always live in that fear of relapse, and you're a prime example of what it, what to do if that happens, you know. As for everybody else to share, Dave's, Chris, as you guys, it was nice hearing you share. I've seen a lot of your guys' struggles, and it's, the way I see it is the enemy's not winning. You know, that addiction isn't winning, and just stay in these rooms. It does get better as you go on, and, you know, those amends are important. I've never had this much support. My four-year marker has shown me that I have a lot of support and gained my family's support back by working my program. I'm just very grateful for Valley Group and Bill for asking me, because I tried dodging Bill for like a whole week, 10 days to be exact, to share, and I blamed it on asking my sponsor and my boss, and he sent me a picture of, right next to my sponsor, so I couldn't say no, you know. But I'm very grateful for that, because if it wasn't for my share, my mom and my brother would have never attended an AA meeting, and, you know, they, when we left, they told me how much they want to be here to support not only me, but the fellowship. You know, my mom's reached out to me to check on Leah and another, one of our sisters in the group, and it's just amazing to be able to have that open communication with my mother about everything, you know. She's like, man, I didn't know you drank at 9 years old. Really? Like, Mom, you were at the bar. What'd you expect? You know? So just very grateful for the program, for your guys' share, and with that, I'll keep coming back.
Hey, thanks, Gloria. All right, so the Valley Group encourages sponsorship and service to our fellowship. We invite you to come early to stand for pain to get better acquainted with our